Now I'm turning to Andrew Kachins, who is Senior Fellow and Director of the CSIS Russia and Eurasia Program. His topic is competing and collaborative visions of Eurasian integration. By the way, you have the bios of all the speakers and folders, so you can see more about that. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Margarita, and thanks very much to Marlena Laurel and the Central Asian Studies Program here at George Washington for inviting me to share a few thoughts with you this afternoon on a topic that I've been spending a lot of time with in the last 5-6 years, and one that I think is of really, truly historic significance. And what's happening, and I'm going to put things in a bit longer historical framework and also in a larger geographic framework. When we talk about Eurasian integration, when I talk about Eurasia, I'm not talking about the former Soviet Union or the post-Soviet space. I'm talking about the supercontinent of Eurasia, from Europe to Asia, from Siberia to India, including the greater Middle East and Southeast Asia, what the British geographer Halford Mackinder would have called 100 years ago the world island. It's reconnecting. It's reconnecting right now. That is the big thing that is happening. Now, of course, Eurasia was connected up until about 500 years ago in the period of the Silk Road days. And the Silk Road, the term is kind of a misnomer because it really was a network of trading routes that connected South Asia to Europe, to the greater Middle East, to East Asia, that connected the greater Middle East and Europe to East Asia. And there was no plan about how this developed. It developed basically according to market principles. And it put Central Asia and the broader Caspian Basin right at the center of this world for a period of 500, more than for hundreds of years, maybe a thousand years, depending upon how you calculate. But Fred Starr, in a new book this year called Lost Enlightenment, has really captured in great detail, and when I say great detail, I mean great detail, a very, very rich book about the scientific, the artistic, the cultural achievements that were taking place from a period of 750 to 1150, kind of the Renaissance period, if you will, in Central Asia, in which this region, in these areas of human inquiry and knowledge, were far ahead of Europe at the time, and frankly, far ahead of most of the rest of the world. And what that kind of those sorts of achievements, this period of remarkable human achievement, was facilitated because they were hugely prosperous. And they were prosperous because they were at the center of these trading routes for hundreds of years. Some of the biggest cities in the world at that time, Balkh, Merv, and others, were located in this region. And I was reminded of this richness in a visit to India at the end of August, when I spent time in Delhi and Chennai, formerly Madras. And, you know, sometimes terms that you've known all your life, but you see in a different way when you're actually in a different place. Like the Euro-Indian linguistic group.
Indo-European.
Indo-European, thank you very much. Suffering a little bit of jet lag, just coming back from Russia a couple of days ago. Indo-European, thank you very much. Well, Indo-European, what does it mean? It means that India was connected to Europe. Languages of Sanskrit and German are actually quite close linguistically. And why is that? It's because those two regions of the Eurasian supercontinent were connected. They were connected through these trading ties, and it brought a lot of cultural, educational ties, etc. with it. Now, the connectivity broke down, as we know, about 500 years ago with the advent of sea trade and also political conflicts that took place over the course of hundreds of years. The Cold War was a particularly anomalous period of disconnectivity. If you think about it, in the Cold War, the Soviet Union, or Russia, China, and India, the three largest countries of Eurasia, were relatively not integrated into the world trading system. They were fairly isolated. The three largest economies of the Eurasian continent, unless you were to put together the EU as a whole. Well, obviously that began to change in the late 1970s with the Chinese opening And then it was accelerated in the early 1990s with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the breakdown of borders, and the introduction of market principles as a more of a guiding force in the development of the Russian and other regional economies. And then India as well, with the reforms that took place in the middle 1990s. Here's a phenomenon that's quite extraordinary. 20 years ago, there was Sino-Indian trade was so marginal, it was less than $500 million a year. Today, that trade is, China is India's largest trade partner, more than $100 billion a year. So that's more than 30x growth in the course of 20 years. Now that's a major phenomenon that has an impact on political calculations in both Delhi and in Beijing. I'll get back to towards the end of my remarks. Now, we did, first of all, this notion of a Silk Road. With all due respect to Secretary Clinton and her speech in Chennai in July of 2011, it's not an American idea. And in fact, attaching it to Afghanistan, it really is an Afghan idea. And it goes back to the first Afghan national development strategies that were talked about going back to 2005, 2006. The United States was relatively kind of a latecomer in this. I got attracted to this quite accidentally, but it was when we did some studies of the Northern Distribution Network, CSIS, back in beginning in early 2009. One of my colleagues had dinner with General Petraeus in January of 2009, just after he'd gotten back from Central Asia, was starting to negotiate the new transit corridors to supply our troops in Afghanistan, which subsequently became called the Northern Distribution Network. I thought it'd be an interesting thing to study. I thought, yeah, that'd be an interesting thing to study. What attracted me to it, though, was it would get a handle on what I had a sense of was this much larger phenomenon happening in the Eurasian continent, how these new trade transit corridors and development and this reconnecting process that was going on. If Afghanistan can be can be accessible to commerce, and it's important to know that we were supplying our troops in theater, more than 85% of what we supply our troops with is our non-lethal goods. Those non-lethal goods are all supplied by commercial carriers. Before the NDN came into place, all of those non-lethal goods were coming through the port of Karachi and going across the AFPAC border through the Turkmenchaman gates. They were traveling virtually through enemy territory. It's like, wow, enemy territory. How's it getting through? Basically, those people, they're on both sides of the border, they made money. They were making calculations about, well, maybe it's more in my interest, my family's interest, that I facilitate this trade rather than block this trade, blow up this trade, or steal this trade. That's the concept. And for General Petraeus at the time, and I talk about this because it's very fundamental in understanding, I think, the key principles in how these new trade and transit corridors are developing. The problem from a military standpoint is we were dependent upon one ground block of communication, that one corridor. And if going back to 2008, 2009, we're looking at, one, much greater demand because of an increased military presence in Afghanistan, and also concerns about being overly leveraged to the port operators in Karachi, the trucking industry in Pakistan, etc. So you create competition. You can have more throughput, and plus you get different countries trying to compete to be part of this network. Competition, that's what's fundamental about this. We took a trip down to CENTCOM in May of 2009 to talk with them. They were really thrilled to talk to somebody from Washington who actually cared about or was even aware of the Northern Distribution Network that they were doing. And, the route that the CENTCOM people were most excited about would have gone through what country? Iran. Why Iran? It's the straightest shot. You already had port infrastructure built. That would be the easiest way to do it. But obviously, for political reasons, we can't do that. And in fact, when the U.S. government talks about New Silk Road, we can't even talk about Iran. Iran actually has very serious interests in the New Silk Road. 4 years ago at the Regional Economic Cooperation Conference for Afghanistan that was held part of now what is the sort of the Heart of Asia process was held in Istanbul, I sat next to the Iranian representative. I talked to him a little bit about our ideas about, you know, thinking about the lessons from the NDN, applying them, thinking about them in a modern Silk Road context, now called the New Silk Road. Of course, the Iranians are very enthusiastic about it. The Iranians have been doing a lot on this front for years, building connectivity from Iran through into Western Afghanistan, of course, Herat. And the Central Asian states as well are quite interested in this concept. I was just in Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan earlier this year, and a new railhead is being completed. Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Iran. This is very important for the Central Asians to be able to have access to the sea. This is their easiest access to the sea. Now, the connectivity between Central Asia and South Asia is very important, and the Indians are extremely enthusiastic about this. From an Indian perspective, you know, again, for hundreds of years, thousands of years, India was connected to its north. Basically, about 200 years ago, when the British Empire and the Russian Empire met each other, that sort of established this horizontal east-west line that blocked off India's connectivity to much of other regions on the Eurasian continent. They would very, very, very much like to break through this. And I think there's an important development that took place this September in Dushanbe, the decision of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to expand its membership to include India, Pakistan, other members, Mongolia, possibly Turkey, and certainly Iran is very clear that it wants to join the organization. And someday, hopefully, in the not-too-distant future, when it's not under a sanctioned regime, then it would be eligible to join. But this expansion of the membership of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, I think, is a development that could be of great significance. If you think about the possibilities for economic cooperation in a broader Eurasian framework in which Central Asia is at the heart, and also for security cooperation, thinking about the future of Afghanistan as the American military presence is smaller, I think with the expanded membership, it creates a possibility for the organization to play a greater role. Now, this may sound kind of counterintuitive because you say, wait a second. You know, when you get more members in an organization, doesn't it make it usually more difficult for the organization to reach consensus about anything? And especially an organization with such diverse membership as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, how are India and Pakistan, enemies for the most, you know, they regard each other as enemies, how is that going to make the organization function more easily? Well, it may not. But the reason why I would say why it may is because the Russians have been reluctant for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to do much. Why? Because they see the organization as an extension of Chinese domination and political influence. And that makes them feel, I think, somewhat awkward, somewhat insecure about the organization. They find that two other large members in there, especially India, a longtime ally and traditional friend of Moscow, is there. I think this may dilute, to some extent, Russian opposition to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization being more active in this area. Now, let's leave you with this one kind of larger thought that I've been puzzling over for the last 5-6 years as we've, at CSIS, where I work, where we've been studying this Eurasian integration phenomenon. You know, the phenomenon, as Deputy Assistant Secretary Sumar rightly said, it's fundamentally driven by private sector activities. It's economic forces that are driving this, and primarily what's behind those economic forces are private sector interests. Now, in some countries, the private sector and the state sectors can be a little bit harder to separate, but nevertheless, I would stand by that contention. So, and the process of this connectivity, it's taking place as we sit here. It's been taking place for years. Some of you have seen my presentations on this in the past. I usually use a graphic. And it's a graphic. It was a 1999 formerly classified, now unclassified graphic of satellite telecommunications activity throughout the world one day in 1999. And what you see in the graphic is throughout the northern hemisphere, it's all black, i.e. it's filled in. There's a lot of activity. There's a lot of connectivity. There's one relatively white spot, one relatively empty spot. Probably the epicenter of that empty spot would be the Afghanistan-Tajikistan border, right around there. Central Eurasia, if you will, relatively disconnected, as we know, the most disconnected part of the world. But it's getting filled in, and it's been getting filled in. And the question is, to what extent does that process need for its facilitation some kind of organization or institutional framework to support it? Or to what extent will it continue to happen in a more kind of what Adam Smith would call the free hand? I don't have an answer to the question. It's an interesting one to look at in its development. And just the last thought to leave you with, to emphasize something else that Mrs. Sumar said. You know, what is the greatest obstacle to this connectivity? And this is one of the big things we discovered in our NDN studies, and anyone who's studied logistics and trade and transit knows this very well. But it was interesting to see, because you think of, well, what would people think would be the biggest obstacles to transit of commercial goods into Afghanistan? Lack of infrastructure? Well, okay, there's almost no railroad in Afghanistan. Railroad was consciously not built in Afghanistan because Afghan leadership more than 100 years ago was concerned that would facilitate Russian and or English domination of Afghanistan. No, that's not the biggest obstacle. Okay, well, what about physical insecurity? Well, that's an obstacle as well, but it's not the biggest one. The biggest obstacle is basically borders acting as toll booths. It's all the institutional, bureaucratic drags on the predictability of the cost and the time of delivery. As Mrs. Sumar said, cost and time are the critical factors, but also that is predictability. Private sector actors need to have confidence about how long it's going to take and how much it's going to cost for things to get through. And that gets to the fundamental problem of institutional problems, political problems within countries, between countries. And that's what's going to be key for Central Asian countries and the Central Asian region to play a much bigger role into the future in the development of these transit corridors. Thanks.
Thank you. And you're coming here, Andy, to the issue of not only trans-border infrastructure, customs, and crossing borders and so on, but we're coming here to the issue of corruption, which is playing a big role in delaying goods and obstructing transit of goods in a timely manner. And now I'm turning to Farouk Irnazarov, who is Country Director and Researcher at the Central Asia Development Institute in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. He's right now Rumsfeld Fellow at the Central Asia Caucus Institute. He's going to talk about regional cooperation in Central Asia, evidence from the field. Very interesting topic. This is something that everybody wished to be going much better in the region.
Thank you, Margarita. Thank you, Marlene, for inviting me, and thank you, everyone, for coming. One thing was crossing my mind while I was sitting and listening to these interesting presentations, that basically in the United States, whenever we talk about regional cooperation in Central Asia, you immediately bring Afghanistan on board. When you listen to similar presentations in continental Europe, I deliberately use continental, avoiding Britain, then basically you revolve around Central Asia itself, and then you slowly try to find common issues between European Union, Central Asia, and things like that. And then when you organize such events in Central Asia, then you talk about mutual differences between countries, not about integration itself, which is quite interesting. The same topic, but different stances. I would like to take a slightly different perspective on Central Asian cooperation and integration, collaboration, whatever word we may use. I would like to talk about issues per se, and then how actually players in Central Asian markets do resolve these issues. Why I'm doing this? My presentation is based on almost 600 interviews throughout the region, and the idea is when you open a typical report of international organization or article, then you basically can see that there are lots of issues for Central Asian countries, and as a panacea might be a regional integration or regional integration organization, which may potentially solve issue for the benefit of all countries. Yes, it's true, but then I was interested how to see it, like what the players actually think, what actors think about this issue. And I went to the field and asking about perception, what actually entrepreneurs and businessmen think about potential integration. Especially I did this in two largest countries, in Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, and I was surprised that basically businessmen and entrepreneurs were not that much eager to cooperate with each other. The major issue they highlighted was the issue of lack of information. They said that we have information vacuum, entrepreneurs in Uzbekistan, about market in Kazakhstan or in neighboring Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan. And the least one is actually production cost, which is amazing. So production cost was the minor problem for them, taking into account the entire pyramid of issues. And then you may for a second think that this was an issue for maybe this is how they treat, they internally oriented. But this is not exactly true, because you talk to entrepreneurs in Central Asia and you may be absolutely surprised and stunned how much they know about manufacturing industry in Russia, for example, about legislation in Russia, and or, for example, in Turkey or in China. But they know little about each other. And there is a huge information vacuum, and some entrepreneurs did complain about this, saying, you know, we're really interested in going there, but we don't know how. If someone comes and teaches us how, then we can do it. Other people were saying that, you know, the issue is our market is not saturated itself, and then we need more time for ourselves. That's why we are not that much eager to go abroad and then expand our business, which is a legitimate statement. But then the problems, one of the biggest problems, and we actually already mentioned that, is a customs problem. And if you think for a moment, the average speed of the cargo crossing countries like starting from Kazakhstan and ending to Turkmenistan will be 25 kilometers, which is like, if my math is correct, it's like 13, 14 miles, which is amazing. It moves like a turtle in a way. And the reason for that is not that the lorries or trucks are that bad or the roads are that dreadful. Of course, they are not fantastic, but still. The issue is that customs takes so much time, the bureaucracy and all those issues. And then when we talk about this, and you can find this is nothing new. You can find this information in many reports and articles. But what is really missing, that how actually to deal with this issue. What reports suggest that we basically have to reform, have to, you know, the government should think about it, or we should help, like, you know, should bring some foreign help, and then in one moment basically lift or remove those barriers. This is not a successful strategy, taking into account that for the countries, for the governments of those countries, it's quite difficult to reform everything at once. I believe it's much more, it can be much more fruitful if pinpoint some particular customs points, checkpoints, and then go and try to bring this, understand how they work and their problems, and then basically bring it to the government saying, look, we understand that everything cannot be done at the same time, but we believe that this one is an essential checkpoint and it can be done in a better way without, like, criticizing, because with criticism you should be really careful. So basically we bring in on board these issues and understanding, and then if it's successful, one may use it as a role model for other checkpoints, and then this is the way to go. But reforming or expecting to be reformed this at once is a bit naive, I would say. And then the problem also about divergent foreign policy priorities, we already talked that Kazakhstan is more eager to cooperate than, for example, Turkmenistan and also Uzbekistan. But this issue also should be taken into account, that the interests of those countries. And when we talk about bottom-up approach, when we talk about entrepreneurs and about expanding businesses, one of the solutions could be that creates some kind of Central Asian Chamber of Commerce. It doesn't exist. So this chamber can go to different countries and basically advertise opportunities. Another thing can be a Central Asian Business TV channel, just to fill this vacuum, just to show what is exactly happening in neighboring markets, about potential opportunities, and then, like, some businesses can advertise themselves. And this will intensify these links at a much, much higher level, and it will accelerate the integration itself. Also, it's essential to understand that there is a mismatch between infrastructure, so there is a targeted, there is a need for targeted infrastructure. If you look at economic corridors, which were built by the Asian Development Bank with the help of the Asian Development Bank, even at the Asian Development Bank, they are now thinking, okay, we did build these economic corridors and these roads, but what else? Does it really benefit people like around those corridors? And now they're thinking of coming up with some new initiative of creating some kind of concept of economic corridors, building infrastructure along these roads. Also, the bureaucracy is a huge issue, and but sometimes in the literature, I think that's a huge focus that this bureaucracy is a deliberate strategy. Well, sometimes yes, but in most cases, I would say it's a human factor sometimes, and then people are just not being trained. People just not right people on the job, and they just don't know how to deal with these issues. And that's why it's essential to address those issues from the right angle. I was thinking about why not to create some kind of program like Erasmus program in Europe, where students can freely go. Like that's a nice initiative by Nazarbayev University to offer scholarships for Central Asian students, another one at OSCE Academy. But in general, why not create some kind of linkage between universities where students may study one semester in one Central Asian country, another semester in another Central Asian country, and then basically it will be much easier to integrate and to understand each other. Because those Central Asians who do not travel, they have absolutely, I would say, skewed and distorted picture of what's going on in a neighboring country. So just to give you some excerpts from the interviews, one of the interviewees said in Kazakhstan, everything is bad in Uzbekistan. You know, economically we are much better, so why we should go and integrate? Why we should do something with that? And then I went to Uzbekistan, talked to people there. They said, look at us. We are self-sustainable. Look at Kazakhstan. They borrowed so much money. You know, and then they're in trouble. You know, we are basically, look at our debt and look at how we can easily use the production chains within the country without just borrowing from other countries. So this kind of understanding is there in the air, unfortunately. And to combat this, it's essential to tackle it with filling this vacuum and then to bring this on board. Of course, it can be a bit difficult with the case of Turkmenistan. But still, I think it's quite doable. And last thing which I would like to conclude with is the issue of labor migrants who are traveling to Russia mostly. And it's no one knows, there is no study about that, what exactly changes in their minds and perceptions when they come back. So do they get some kind of Russian understanding of things, or they come opposing or coming up with their own ideas, and how does it basically influence the integration processes within the region? And just to give you, it's actually really good that like railways and everything are being built, but at the same time, I'm an economist and I cannot live without numbers. And if we look at the numbers, which is quite amazing, it's numbers from 2012, flights from Uzbekistan to Russia, monthly flights, 946 flights to Russia, 84 to Turkey, and then only 27 to all Central Asian countries. You see, that's a striking difference between 946 flights to Russia and 27 to all Central Asian countries. I read today, before coming here, that basically Air Astana would like to double flights to Tashkent, but even that, it's the situation is not adequate to what the region to match the region's potential, and this is the issue. And this is not the issue only with Uzbekistan. You can say that okay, because there are lots of labor migrants in Uzbekistan, that's why they are traveling to Russia that much, and that's why there is a need for that flights. But if you look at Kazakh numbers, they're striking as well, 441 flights to Russia, and they don't export their labor migrants to Russia, and 187 to Turkey. And again, 27 to Central Asian countries. So these issues, of course, I would like to be optimistic as Ms. Sumar and seeing that from the top we can change that. But unfortunately, at the moment, as it stands, there are attempts. But these attempts should be actually, in a way, encouraged from the basic, from the field, from the grassroots level, and this will help to address another issue of Afghanistan. Because when you talk to entrepreneurs in Central Asia, they are not even viewing Afghanistan as a potential market, which is kind of sad. And for Afghans, they're actually eager to work in Central Asia, work with Central Asian countries, to cooperate, to trade with them. But at the same time, they say, look, how we can trade with them if to get the visa to Uzbekistan is much more difficult than to get visa to United States? So this is a huge issue for Afghans, but as like I said, that at the moment, Washington sees this region, Afghanistan included, but once you go to the region, you can see, despite the geographical proximity, Afghanistan is not being part of the region. But to finish in an optimistic note, I would like to say that no matter what barriers exist in Central Asia, Central Asian people remain very entrepreneurial. So whenever some problems occur, they don't say, oh, okay, my business is going to fall and I'm going to go and become bankrupt. So the problem. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to look for some loopholes and I'm going to find my way to survive in this market and to prosper. So this is a good attitude, and I would like to urge you to have this attitude towards everything. Thank you.
Thank you very much. How do you count these flights? Are they destinations? Because they're weekly flights from one place to another.
This is monthly flights.
Okay,
and
monthly
flights. Yeah, this is monthly flights, and this to all cities of Russia.
Okay.
Yeah, and to all cities of Turkey and Central Asian countries.
So that reminds me of the old saying in the Balkans that the shortest way from one Balkan country to another is to go via Vienna, through Vienna. Well, that changed. Well,
in Central Asia, it's via Istanbul.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
That changed.
That's
so
the Turkmen way, actually.
In the Balkans, yeah. And I really hope that it's going to change in Central Asia as well. And now we have Gulimjan Kirbasov from Columbia University. He's going to talk about integrated approach in combating transnational crimes in Central Asia. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to the discussions. And actually, I would like to speak more about in this regional integration issues. I want to shift focus not to institutional integration, like political integrations we've recently been experiencing, but more I want to talk about issue-based integration. So specifically, I want to talk about international terrorism, transnational terrorism in Central Asia, and how an integrated approach should be adopted to counter that threat. And because I'm educated here in the United States, I'll be bringing Afghanistan and Pakistan to this issue. And first, I wanted to have an integrated approach to fight transnational terrorism. We need to find out the causes of this terrorism and how it operates, how the mobilization goes on in this terrorism. So if we know these causes, we can approach with our comprehensive strategy. So one of the causes in the literature and in the scholarly literature of the terrorism and the rebellion and the insurgency have been cited as grievances, political grievances, or economic deprivation, political exclusion, discrimination against certain groups, ethnic groups, and those groups are not satisfied with their status in the country, and then they take up arms and rebel against the government. But more than that, there have been also scholars arguing that the grievance is not enough. It's there need to be some expected payoff from the participation to these groups and taking up arms, and some selective incentives so that every participant of these groups could benefit from participation, material benefits. So, and but these, after the Cold War especially, after the collapse of the Cold War, after the end of the Cold War, these causes of transnational terrorism was not enough to explain the activities, terrorist activities, because there could be political exclusion and grievances in one country, but those groups could get finances from other countries. So there are financial support from the different countries for the cause of another country. So to tackle these issues of transnational terrorism, we need to address all these issues, as I will come later. And currently, the Central Asia is experiencing threats from mainly two regions. One is Afghanistan, Pakistan, and another is Iraq and Syria. And for example, just to give an example from of threat from Afghanistan and Pakistan region, I just want to give an example of Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, and it started from operating from Tajikistan region, and then it moved to Afghanistan, and then moved to Pakistan, training, operating in different countries, getting their finances from different sources. And these kind of movements, after the Afghan, after the U.S. troop withdrawal totally from the Afghanistan, can easily make their operations and trainings more easily in those regions and operate from those regions in Central Asia. So, in an integrated approach to address the issue of transnational terrorism, we need to look at different points. For example, one is how these groups finance themselves. For example, just have an example of Afghanistan and Pakistan. The main source of the their finance was production and trade of narcotics and opium, poppy cultivation, and illicit trade, and for example, the U.S. In Afghanistan has spent $7.6 billion, as maybe you've read from the news, to fight the narcotic production and cultivation. But the UN data gives us that in 2013, opium poppy cultivation was at the record high, measured by the hectare of the cultivated opium poppies. And this means that so many so many resources was mobilized to counter this threat, but it wasn't very efficient, and because it needs more integrative approach, not only to destroy the destroy the puppies, but also to look at the demand side, to look at that how they transit from one country to another country, and border control, and all of these issues. If not approached as an integrated strategy, then just tackling one side is won't solve the problem. And as a for example, to to fight with specific groups and transnational terrorism that's coming from Afghanistan and Pakistan, there should be an integrated strategy that will involve international organizations like UN and the neighboring governments of Afghanistan and Afghan tribes that operate as very autonomously within the Afghanistan and who has very who can exercise really a huge power, and elders in Afghanistan, they should be integrated in this approach. Mostly what UN and the US has been following in counterterrorism, they were mostly involving only governments of these nations, with excluding, they were not engaging really the community leaders and the elders and the civil societies, not in the formal form, but in the traditional form, without really integrating all of these actors. I don't think that a single strategy will solve the problem of transnational terrorism. And another threat coming from Iraq and Syria, as we all know that the ISIS and Al-Qaeda and related groups, they are financing their activities by selling oil and diesel to neighboring countries or in the states, and they estimate that it's $3 million per day they earn that much money, and it's the not only we can they are using the network of networks of smuggling that was left in the from the 90s when there was a UN and US embargo against Saddam Hussein, and there was a black market and smugglers that traded this oil, and those network of smuggling is being used right now again. And all of why am I telling this? Because just one approach, unilateral approach, and not integrated strategy to tackle these issues will not solve the problem in the in any way. That's why, for example, in this particular region, Iraq and Syria, for integrated strategy, we need to work with international organizations as UN, EU, and Arab League, and the national governments of Iraq, Syria, and neighboring countries, and sub-national entities like Kurdistan and possibly Free Syrian Army, and also religious and traditional authorities of power, which operates and which had been operating there in Iraq and Syria for hundreds of years. So without including all those sub-national and very local communities and actors, they're just bombing and fighting those terrorists will not solve the problem. So recently we organized with the UN, specifically with UNITAR and the Yale University, we organized a workshop with representatives from Iraq and Syria and from the US, and how they see that the problem can be solved. And there was a representative of Ayatollah Sistani in the workshop, and from the Sunni groups we had religious leaders, and they all said that without going to these community level engagements and the very local engagements, you won't be able to cut the finances, cut the radicalization of the youth, and join their prevent their participation in the groups, and you won't be able to control the borders without integrating those very local actors. So by recently you have you probably all know that UN Security Council have adopted a resolution unanimously, resolution 2178. That's on the foreign terrorist fighters, and in that strategy, it was more comprehensive, and it could be seen as a framework that the Central Asian states can use to fight against the terrorism that comes from very different regions. So that that framework is binding, and it requires states to actually the article that 16, for example, it asks governments to work with the very local civil societies, local leaders and communities. And it could be used as a framework, institutional framework, to work towards more integrated approach to fight terrorism. I want to just summarize my presentation by saying that with the integrated approach and strategy, I mean on integrating across two main categories. One is integration across stakeholders, that is international organizations, UN, and regional organizations, the Arab League, and other, for example, Istanbul process, and the local governments, and local communities, tribal and religious leaders, and civil society. This is the integration across the stakeholders. These all units and actors needs to be integrated in the approach against the fight against the terrorism. And the second type is integration across issues. The national security policies and the counterterrorism policies should be integrated into development policies, development in political, economic, and social spheres. So without integrating counterterrorism and counter-narcotics, without integrating that strategy to development strategies, you won't be able to solve it in the long term. And civil society development, particular attention to moderate religious societies and intra-faith dialogue among those were basically came out of the workshop we held at Yale recently. And I believe that this kind of not the political institutional integration per se, but the issue-based integration to fight specifically this threat, it will be more productive and productive in fighting the terrorism. Thank you.